From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Thousands of Californians are without power as a precautionary measure to prevent wildfires. It's the first wave, and it's happening in the Bay Area. We'll hear how folks up north are dealing with it, and also maybe what we can learn from the situation in case the lights go out down here in SoCal. Plus, if you like staying through the credits of a movie, why more women are in charge of making them now than ever before. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Thanks for choosing us on your Thursday. Now, enjoy the calm weather while we've got it, because the Santa Ana winds are expected to kick in overnight here in L.A. Coming up on today's show, we're going to find out how students in the Los Angeles Unified School District performed on the most recent round of standardized tests. And we'll also speak with best-selling fantasy author Leigh Bardugo about her first novel for adults, Ninth House.
When I was about 11, we moved to Hancock Park, and it truly was like crash landing on an alien planet.
That conversation coming up in about 45 minutes, but we start today's show with our eyes toward the north. As you may have heard here on KPCC, the energy provider, Pacific Gas and Electric, shut off power to more than 140,000 Bay Area customers in the early hours this morning. It's the first wave of blackouts to deter potentially devastating wildfires, but the shutoffs have caused issues for other agencies in the area. Here to give us a sense of how the Bay Area is navigating the situation, we have Mina Kim. She's the evening news anchor for KQED's NPR station in the region. Mina, thanks for joining Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've been following this news as a reporter, but you also live in Napa Valley, which is one of the areas experiencing the power shutoffs. Were you expecting to wake up without electricity this morning?
You know, I really had no idea, because when I tried to check the PG&E website yesterday and enter in my address to find out if I would be impacted, the website was down for much of the day.
Oof.
Luckily, I had a sense that we would have power, and I did end up having power this morning because I wasn't getting constant alerts to my cell phone. And very early in the morning yesterday, it initially said I would not be impacted. But they were telling me to please check back every few hours, so there was some uncertainty this morning. And then, of course, one of the biggest impacts I saw this morning was to traffic. I mean,
yeah.
The morning commute was tough because with the power out, all the traffic intersections were four-way stops, essentially. So that made people's 10-minute commutes within Napa 45 minutes long, which, of course, has an impact on productivity, which has an impact on the environment. So that's just the tip of the iceberg.
This lack of communication, Mina, though, was it a little disconcerting?
It was very disconcerting. And the important thing, about communication is that if you know you're not going to be impacted, then you don't have to rush to the grocery
yeah.
store to try to get provisions, to try to get ice. But the fact that you didn't know for sure meant pretty much everybody had to make sure that they had things on hand just in case. So last night, the Safeway up here ran out of ice by 6 p.m. That was here in Napa. Also, there were long lines at, you know, gas stations, and that was backing up traffic. There was a run on generators at the Home Depot. And so that's why the communication piece of this is so important. And that definitely has been frustrating for a lot of local officials, not just in terms of how they're communicating directly with their residents and their constituents, but also how they're communicating with local leaders.
You mentioned the traffic. Aside from that, what's been the biggest challenge for you today with so much of the area experiencing power outages?
Well, interestingly, one of the biggest challenges for me personally is the fact that all the schools closed.
Oh,
there
yeah,
was
yep.
It's unclear why all the schools in the district had to close in Napa, even though some of the schools would have power. I don't quite know why that happened yet, but that for me and hundreds of other parents, that meant a scramble for childcare. That meant missing a day of work if they weren't able to get childcare. I also have relatives in other parts of Napa and Sonoma who are without power. And so I had to make sure that I could accommodate them in my home today as well. So that's just like a small piece of it, but it just gives you a sense of the ripple effect of these kinds of things. And then, of course, there's the much bigger considerations of people who rely on power for medical equipment, very vulnerable members of our population who are very sensitive to temperature changes and things like that. And what we're getting in terms of communication is that this power outage has no estimated time for ending. So there is no estimate of power restoration. Unofficially, I'm hearing 3 to 5 days. That's a big difference between 3 to 5 days in terms of how long you are without power. It is a very disorienting experience.
You mentioned how traffic has been different because everything's a four-way stop. What have you seen in terms of patience? Are we being kind to each other up there?
You know, I think for the most part, people seem pretty civil, but I've got to tell you, I had the benefit of leaving very early in the morning, so it wasn't too bad. Mm. At the time that I left, which was around 5:30, 6 a.m., there weren't police out there running traffic stops or helping to direct traffic, but that may have changed over the course of the morning as the commute got worse. But I, in addition to anchoring the evening news here, I also host a talk show, and I invited listeners to call in with their experiences. And one of the people that called in was actually a field worker for PG&E. And they were basically saying, we're so sorry you're experiencing this, but please know that we field workers did not make this decision to shut off your power preemptively. That was corporate. So, you know, we feel your pain and we're doing the best we can. So I appreciated that because I think it is important for us right now to be as patient as possible, even with all the questions.
Now, you reported on the fires in Sonoma County in 2017, so you've seen firsthand the destruction that a major fire can do. Do you think this move, what you're going through up there, what your neighbors are going through up there, at this scale was necessary?
That is the central question. I think the answer is unclear because it really depends on the scope and the extent of this power shutoff. But I can tell you, nobody would prefer their town to burn than to experience just a period of inconvenience with blackouts. Absolutely not. But I think one of the listeners that I spoke with this morning said it best when he said, look, I would definitely rather have a blackout than a fire. But I would also much rather have a power grid that was safe, that wasn't so prone to wildfire, which then raises the question of why. Why is it that we had to resort to this? Was there deferred maintenance on PG&E's part? Should they have been doing more to secure their power poles or to clear the vegetation around their power poles? So we're just, I guess, trying to deal the best we can with this situation. But there are a lot of questions being raised about why the situation had to get as bad as it did. I mean, you mentioned at the top that 140,000 people in the Bay Area are already experiencing a power shut off. That number is expected to grow over the course of this day as communities in to the south of San Francisco and the east of San Francisco are supposed to experience a power shut off sometime between now and the evening. But all told, this power shut off could affect 800,000 people in 34 Northern California counties. Wow. I mean, you're talking about 30,000 people potentially in LA. Think about 800,000 people up here in Northern California.
That's rough. Mina Kim, KQED news anchor and Napa resident, give us an update on the power shutoffs in the Bay Area. Mina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Staying with the power shutoffs, we now go to Sonoma County. The region has faced some of the largest outages. A PG&E spokesperson told the San Francisco Chronicle that 67,000 residences and businesses in the county lost their power last night. And to find out how the county is managing, we have Maggie Fleming on the line. She's the communications manager for Sonoma County. Maggie, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So describe the last few hours managing the county during the power shutoffs. What's it been like?
Yeah, so we've been working around the clock since we first heard about the potential shutoffs. And our first phase really was just getting the word out to help our residents prepare. And the scope is actually bigger than you mentioned. So the 66,000 that PG&E was referring to was their customers. In terms of residents, it's approximately 262,000 people that have been impacted. And we're still waiting on the actual numbers of what came through. But that's kind of the large population we're working with, which is half of the county. And so really, it's been a huge effort just to make sure that everyone is prepared, has the information they need, and knows where to go for resources.
Maggie, what are the biggest concerns right now?
Well, several of them were mentioned before, so definitely traffic safety is a big one, especially as it gets dark. And we're also really aware of we too have a red flag up here that's going into effect this evening through the night with very strong winds. And the National Weather Forest says that it could be the strongest offshore non-offshore wind event since the fires that happened 2 years ago. And so we're very much, you know, aware that in addition to the power outage, we could also have another fire event. So we're staffing up and making sure that people are, you know, making sure that they get their alerts, that they're also staying vigilant, they're checking with their neighbors, and they're just ready if they need to be ready for an evacuation as well as the power outage. So and if, residents are definitely going through a lot right now.
And if emergency services are needed, how are they affected by the shutoffs?
Yeah, so right now we've actually been fairly fortunate in that the cell phone, for the most part, cell phones have still been functioning. And so our emergency service teams are highly active and increased numbers for our fire districts doing patrols. And so far we've been pretty lucky. We also have, our airport. We're anticipating that might close. That stayed open. So a lot of our services that we were kind of preparing for the worst case scenario have proven to not be shut down. But we're still, a lot of this with the information that PG&E provided for us, a lot of it is estimates and a lot of it was kind of guesswork. So this is really our first time dealing with an event of this scale. So we're learning a lot as we go along.
How's that communication going with PG&E right now? We heard that maybe it's not going as smoothly as everyone had hoped.
That's correct. It's a work in progress. So we had a smaller scale event last month that only impacted about 1,000 people. And so from that event, we've been pressuring for a lot more communication and transparency and advance notice. And we've gotten some, but it's still, there's a lot of room for improvement. We are only able to share information as we hear from PG&E. And, as was mentioned before, PG&E's website was out. And so really there hasn't been the level of information available to our residents that is needed from PG&E at this time.
Maggie, one more thing really quick. You got a smaller scale shutoff in September, Sonoma County did. How does this one compare? And did it help you prepare right now for this one?
It did help us prepare. So at that time, PG&E actually gave us a similar projection for the number of people that could be impacted. And at the last minute, due to the weather conditions improving, they scaled it way down to only 1,000 people. But there was a period there of at least 1 to 2 days where we were anticipating it could be the same scale. And so we did a lot of work preparing
good.
And getting ready. So that was really helpful. And yet at the same time, a lot of the things that were, until it actually happens, you don't really know what it's going to look like.
That's Maggie Fleming, Communications Manager with Sonoma County. Maggie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The latest homeless count found about 8,000 people live in campers and RVs on LA County streets. Dozens of residents of a low-cost RV park are faced with the possibility that they may be evicted, adding to the number of camper dwellers on local streets. KPCC's Sharon McNary brings you their story.
I sit with Lacey Borland in the shade of the rental office of the Cali Lake RV Resort north of Santa Clarita. She's cuddling her sleeping baby.
This is Journey.
But she hasn't lived here long. When she and her newborn were discharged from the hospital, they went home to an RV parked underneath a highway overpass in Ventura County.
It was so hot, we couldn't afford to have our generator going. It was 100 degrees the day she was born.
Borland hadn't planned to be living in an RV, but when she and her husband came from Idaho for his job fixing boats at Ventura Harbor, they realized they couldn't afford an apartment nearby. But they could afford an aging RV.
A 1998 newly remodeled Mini Winnie.
They soon discovered that many parks have a so-called 10-year rule, limiting tenants' vehicles to only those built after 2009.
They don't take older RVs. I don't know if it's just because of the transient population. Some people have the really older ones that have the garbage and things laying around. It maybe has the stigma. So we were stuck under an overpass, under a bridge for a few months.
After getting rejections from many parks, she found the Cali Lake RV Resort.
I called them up crying and asking for help, and they stayed open until 10 o'clock that night to let me in.
The ads tout Cali Lake as an RV resort. And sure, it's got a pond and a grassy play area, but the reality, Cali Lake RV Resort is a low-income, tightly packed community on wheels. Rental with hookups, including power, water, and a sewer drain, costs about $825 a month. The park was built for 47 spaces, but the new owners expanded it to more than 100 without a permit. And that's the problem. When state and county officials found out, they told the park owner he'd have to evict his new residents.
My name is Stuart Silver, and I'm a part of the corporation that owns the facility.
He meant to operate Cali Lake as a campground where vacationers stay for a while and then move on. But what he got was very different.
It's a community. And I realized that after we purchased it. And we pretty much couldn't say no to people that are in need, that have to sleep on the streets.
People like Lacey Borland, her husband, and their newborn daughter, and many others.
Everybody here is a permanent resident. If they leave here, there's nowhere for them to go.
To accommodate them, he created more than 50 new spaces, wired them for power, adding sewer drains, and extended the water lines from the well. But soon the problems piled up. County Public Health said his water was contaminated with too much manganese, which turns water brown and can cause nervous system problems. And the State Housing Department said the park's new electrical wiring violated state standards. They told Silver the extra people would have to leave.
People started coming out to us and telling us that they had nowhere to go.
The crackdown upset and frightened the park's residents, like Melissa Long.
And it's not fair that they're going to shut it down for a bunch of people. And who knows? I don't know if it's going to shut us down and we have to leave.
She and husband Rick moved here with their two children in June. It was the only affordable alternative they could find. Their former home in Sylmar cost $2,500 rent, leaving little for the kids.
It was a struggle for a while, and now we have a little bit of a breathing room so we can actually catch up.
Some of the residents contacted County Supervisor Catherine Barger's office, begging not to be evicted. They succeeded. Last week, Barger announced the state and county were backing off the eviction demand to avoid displacing the families while Silver brings the park up to code. Their problem is resolved. For now. But thousands more RV families across the region still lack legal places to park. Could this kind of RV campground be duplicated on public land? An RV resort offering safe housing of last resort. Covering infrastructure, I'm Sharon McNary.
There are lots of good schools for K through 12 kids all over LA County, but even in those good ones, a lot of the kids deal with challenges outside of school that make learning and achievement difficult. Wondering where their next meal's coming from or where they'll sleep, all of those worries make it tough to study, take tests, and also keep up. Coming up, find out what specific group of students have a wider achievement gap than others. That's coming up when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. California education officials released the latest round of statewide standardized test scores this afternoon. These are the English and math tests every public school kid takes. The results, well, a little better than last year, emphasis on the word little, and a deeper dive into the numbers shows some vulnerable groups of kids aren't making as much progress compared with their peers. KPCC's Kyle Stokes has been digging through the test results. He joins us now. Hello, Kyle.
Hi there, Ray.
All right, so let's start as big picture as we can. How did students across California do?
Well, emphasis on the word little, right? There was a little bit of improvement in the statewide number that we care most about, the number of students who are meeting and exceeding statewide standards. Right now, in English language arts, for the first time, more than half of the state students were meeting or exceeding state standards on this new standardized test. For the first time since it debuted 4 years ago, This was supposed to be a new and harder test called the Smarter Balanced Exam. So that number up about a percentage point to 50.87%. In math, there was also a 1 percentage point increase thereabouts to about 39.7%. So about 2 in 5 kids are meeting or exceeding state standards in math.
Okay, so that's the state. What about locally? How did students in our listening area do?
Well, locally, everybody also had sort of modest improvements. You could look at the county level. For instance, LA County had improvements that were about in line with the state. Their numbers overall are in line with the state. Orange County is of the 5 counties of our listening area. That's where test scores are the strongest. It's a little bit closer to 3 in 5 students who are meeting or exceeding standards in English compared to 50% statewide. And Ventura, Riverside, and San Bernardino counties, they also all had increases, but they tend to lag behind the statewide numbers as a whole. If you look at some of the largest districts, for example, LAUSD, the largest school district in the state, they saw an increase of 1.5% in English and 2 percentage points in math. math. I know this is a lot of numbers, but keep up with me. I promise we'll get through the numbers here together. And then I think the biggest mover of the 10 largest school districts here in Southern California, Long Beach Unified, actually had bigger improvements than the state as a whole, than LAUSD did. They're up by almost 3 percentage points in both English and in math. But I think across the board here, the big takeaway that state officials acknowledge is that these top line numbers tend to mask the fact that certain vulnerable groups of kids just aren't making as much progress.
Yeah, right. And we also hear about the term achievement gaps,
right.
This persistent disparity in how well Black and Latino students score on tests compared with white or Asian kids. What's the status of those test score gaps after this latest round of scores?
Yeah, they've gotten a little bit better, but you know, they're essentially unchanged from last year. They're a little bit better than they were when the test debuted 4 years ago, but they're still pretty yawning gaps here. For example, Latino students score about 41% of Latino students are meeting English standards, compared with 65% of white students. If you look at the gaps between Black and white students, they're sort of similar. The biggest gaps are between Black and Latino students and Asian students, for example. Black students, about 33% of Black students are meeting English standards. 77% of Asian students are meeting English standards. And I think that it's important to underline this because it has huge implications for the state's economy, like for the tech sector, Silicon Valley, Silicon Beach. Where are they going to get all of their workers from? Yeah. I was talking with Alicia Smith Arriaga, who's the head of the Education Trust West, an organization that advocates for the closing of these achievement gaps. And that this kind of uncomfortable fact often finds itself, working into conversations that they have with big tech businesses.
We sit in a lot of conversations where we hear about the lack of diversity in the tech sector. But in those same conversations, we don't hear any recognition of the gaps that we see as a state. It just seems like there's a real disconnect in the state between the kind of K-12 education equity conversation and the tech diversity conversation, even though they're very clearly interrelated.
And Smith Arriaga says one of the ways that you can help this, recruit and retain more teachers of color, among a lot of other things.
And one more thing, Kyle, real quick. Achievement gap as a racial issue, that's one thing. What about as an economic issue?
Well, economics obviously make a difference. There are a lot of critics who say standardized tests really only measure the level of poverty in any given school, but it doesn't explain everything. For example, if you look at economically disadvantaged white students, about 34% of them are meeting statewide standards in, I believe it's in English. But if you look at Black students, even the not economically disadvantaged Black students, that number is just 33%. So clearly there's something more going on here than income.
That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. To learn more about the latest round of California test scores, you can read Kyle's work at our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Kyle, thanks.
You're welcome.
Keeping with young people, a UCLA report on Black youth in LA County explores a range of challenges many K-12 students face that negatively affect outcomes in school and beyond. Among them, environmental contamination. Asthma rates for Black children in LA County are almost 3 times higher than for white children. Food insecurity, homelessness, that also factors in. The report makes several policy suggestions to tackle the problems. We're going to hear more from Pedro Noguera, co-author of that report and a professor at UCLA's Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. He just wrapped up a presentation on the report in South Los Angeles. Pedro, thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as a country and as a state, we've made a lot of efforts to close the achievement gap in schools. But according to your report, Black students in LA County continue to face multiple challenges both in and out of school that can undermine success. Tell us about some of the challenges that factor in.
Well, let me start there with the achievement gap, because part of the problem is that we focus too narrowly on achievement as measured by how well kids do on test scores and by what's happening in school, and have ignored what's happening outside of school. And as we show in the report, Black children are disproportionately among the homeless. They're disproportionately amongst the kids who are experiencing food insecurity and hunger, kids who are in foster care. These are needs and issues that schools can't address on their own. And we need to do more to provide the support to those children and the communities where they live if we're going to intervene more effectively.
And what about the health issues because of the environment?
The health issues are serious. We're seeing much higher asthma rates, much higher exposure to lead in the environment, and this has an effect on the development of their brain and the ability of kids to attend school regularly because they're sick. And so the health issues are also quite significant.
And then when they take these tests, that's a big reason why they may not do as well as other kids.
Absolutely. Because when you control for class, so for example, you look at black middle class kids who attend integrated schools, they're doing as well academically as kids from other backgrounds. So we're really talking about the way disadvantages related to poverty and the environment accumulate on children and impact their outcomes.
Phaedra, I was wondering, because these are the kids that need the resources the most, right? Why aren't they getting the resources or the help?
I think part of the problem is political. We have, you know, the county has one set of responsibilities, the school districts, the city. We don't have enough coordination of the approach to address this. We need to have the folks who work in mental health working with the folks in parks and recreation and the schools to deliver better services. Because we live in Los Angeles in a region with vast resources. There's no reason why kids who need tutoring and need support shouldn't be able to get them.
As I mentioned, there have been efforts to at least improve outcomes in schools. Your report points to the No Child Left Behind program, which then President George Bush signed into law back in 2002. Pedro, have things gotten any better for black students in L.A. County in the years since that?
It's barely noticeable. We do see improvements in access to what we call the A through G courses. These are the courses kids need to be eligible for college later. So we've also seen an increase in graduation rates. So I want to acknowledge that there's been effort in school districts, but we continue to see significant lag on most indicators of achievement, and particularly when you look at kids in foster care and kids who are homeless, they're being suspended at the highest rates in our schools. What we're also concerned about is the way they become acceptable, because after a while, people are used to it. And that is also part of the problem, the complacency that results from getting too familiar with these kinds of problems.
Talking to Pedro Noguera, a professor at UCLA's Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. All right, so aside from hopefully not getting used to that, what's it going to take to start turning things around for black youth in LA County?
Well, we need to make sure that a report like this is used to catalyze the will, first of all, within county and city and school districts to work together to take it on. And then we need to mobilize the nonprofit sector and the private sector to play a role. We should have, for example, you know, Los Angeles is now home to some of the biggest high-tech firms in the country. Google, Apple, Amazon, they're all here. Who are going to get jobs in that sector? How do we make sure that the young people in these communities that we're describing are getting the education and training and the internships that will lead to careers in high-wage jobs that can lift people out of poverty? So we have resources in Los Angeles that we should be tapping to address this problem.
Pedro, since we're talking about black kids, how important is it to have African-Americans leading this effort?
Well, I want to say here that black children are not the only children suffering. There are a lot of kids, Hispanic kids, poor white kids. There are a lot of kids out there who are hurting and vulnerable. We drew attention because even as the black population declines, we're still seeing the numbers get worse and worse. And so while black families and black individuals need to be in leadership, it's very important that we say this is not simply a black problem. It is an American problem. Our political leaders, our governor, our mayor, they all need to play a leading role in addressing this. We can't leave it to the black community to solve it by itself.
But would it help to have someone with shared experiences that maybe understands what these challenges are like?
Absolutely. You've got to hear directly from the people most involved, who are most impacted, about their experiences, because they'll tell you why the systems that are currently in place are not working and what kinds of supports might be more responsive and effective.
Now, I understand UCLA is going to partner with a school in South LA to try and bring about some of these changes. What are you going to do differently?
Well, you know, UCLA has adopted the Horace Mann School, which is in a very low-income community, very high need. 50% of the kids at the school are special ed students, and about 30% are homeless. And we're bringing in highly trained teachers. We're bringing in social workers. We're bringing in summer programs. We're doing the kinds of things that many other schools need. I applaud what UCLA, the commitment UCLA has made, but we need to do that for several dozen other schools like it.
Trying to end, Pedro, on a hopeful note, but after all these years, it's kind of disheartening to hear that just getting through school can be a struggle for young black people here. As a community, is there a shift needed on our part to ensure that things change?
Absolutely. But I think part of the shift is to just not accept it. It's so sad that we've come to accept people living on our streets, many of whom are mentally ill. We should not accept that, and we should not accept the large numbers of our kids who are not getting a quality education. This prevents them from being able to support themselves and their families and contributing to our society. It starts by saying we can and must do a better job than we are, and generating the will to sustain a response so that we begin to move in the right direction.
Pedro Noguera co-authored a report examining the challenges that Black young people continue to face in LA County and schools and beyond. Pedro, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, it's generally agreed that the sexual abuse allegations against Harvey Weinstein were one of the big things that sparked the Me Too movement, but we might be seeing something positive coming out of it. Just pay attention to the 2019 movie credits. Hear all about it when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. CME Martinez. Ronan Farrow's new book includes allegations against NBC and how the network tried to block his reporting on Harvey Weinstein. Plus, after years of slow progress, Hollywood has finally hired significantly more women directors this year. Let's go on the lot.
Hey, God is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to give us the latest showbiz news. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Ray.
All right, so The Hollywood Reporter scored an exclusive interview with Ronan Farrow about his upcoming book, Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators. Now, what's it about?
The book is about Farrow tracing his process of working on the Harvey Weinstein story when he began at NBC before ultimately publishing it at The New Yorker. Farrow lays out why that happened, why he went from one outlet to another, as well as the extraordinary lengths Weinstein went to try and block his reporting, including hiring people to spy on him, threatening NBC that he would expose a problem of their own. That ended up coming out later anyway, and that was the allegations of sexual misconduct against Matt Lauer.
Yeah, and I remember the story of him taking that story, different places and wondering what was behind it. So in addition to that, the book also includes what's being described as explosive new allegations. What is he alleging?
Well, the most explosive is an allegation of rape against Matt Lauer by a former NBC staffer, which she said took place during the Sochi Olympics. Lauer responded today with a lengthy letter saying that relationship was consensual. In total, Farrow recounts seven allegations of Lauer's misconduct in the book that seem to contradict what has been NBC's public stance, which is that it had no knowledge of his behavior.
How does the book portray Harvey Weinstein's reach and NBC's culture?
Well, Farrow says that Harvey Weinstein obtained a trove of information about Matt Lauer's alleged workplace misconduct via the publisher of The Inquirer, and that he then used that publisher to pressure NBC News to kill the story.
And Ronan Farrow really digs into NBC in this book. I mean, how has the network responded?
Well, they issued a statement to us, to The Hollywood Reporter, saying that they were never contacted by The Inquirer or made aware of any threats from them or anyone else about Matt Lauer. So they're directly contradicting Ronan Farrow's story.
All right, let's move on now to the box office winner this weekend.
I used to think that my life was a tragedy. But now I realize it's a comedy.
Joker, starring Joaquin Phoenix, delivered the largest October opening weekend ever, $96 million. But even though it was scoring at the box office, it has been getting mixed reviews, and it's a bit polarizing. The Hollywood Reporter spoke to a large number of Academy voters. How did it play to them, Rebecca?
Well, like the critics, the Oscar voters were very mixed. Some people called it outstanding. Other people called it irresponsible. A member of the executive branch talked to my colleague Scott Feinberg and said he had once decided not to make a movie like this because even though he knew it would make money, he was worried about sort of social ramifications. And other people said they didn't understand what The Fosse was all about. It's not that violent. It's just a good movie.
When I saw it on Saturday. And when the movie was over, some people were applauding. Some people were just rolling their eyes. So it, definitely in that movie theater that I was at, it was definitely polarizing. What seems to be the biggest reason for the polarization response to this film?
Well, in some ways, it's a compliment to Joaquin Phoenix and the director Todd Phillips that the movie feels so real, it's upsetting some people. I mean, a central question has been, in a country where mass shootings are commonplace, is it wise to make a movie about a mentally ill loner who attains social stature and acclaim via violence? For the wrong audience, does this become, you know, inspirational?
One of the Academy members that I agreed with the most when it came to what The Hollywood Reporter did was the one who is a female member of the Members at Large branch. And here's a small piece of what she said. It made me uncomfortable from the very first frame to the last. That's what I felt all the way through. I mean, it was just, you didn't know what was going to happen. You didn't know what Joaquin Phoenix was going to do next. And when it comes to that, I guess it's part of his portrayal of someone going through the depths of mental illness. What are people saying about that part?
Well, there has been some controversy about the portrayal of mental illness in the film. Some people have said mental illness is a disability. If you're relying on the trope of the madman, are you either A, stigmatizing it, or B, are you using it as an excuse for violence? I think it's interesting the way the film shows not only that this is a character who has mental illness, but the way in which the system is not helping him. You know, he starts out the movie going to a therapist, having access to medication. For budget reasons, that goes away. It's an interesting question to ponder and, frankly, a pretty serious social question to ask in a comic book movie.
Yeah, and the one thing I will say about this movie, considering all the reaction that I've seen, people that I've talked to that have seen it, a lot of your life's experiences really dictate how you react to this movie. That's something that it seemingly is across the board common to everyone that's seen this movie and has reacted.
Yeah, I would agree with that. For instance, there's a scene in the New York subway, well, the Gotham subway, which is very clearly the New York subway, which felt as, a woman who had ridden the New York subway alone for many, many years, chillingly familiar. And that is actually part of why the movie, though I admired it, was a tough watch for me.
All right. Last but not least, let's talk about some of the progress Hollywood has made in the form of women directors. Break down 2019's numbers for us, Rebecca, when it comes to female directors.
Well, look, for years I've been coming on the show and saying the same statistics year after year when it comes to women directors in these top grossing films. Today, it's different. Variety had an interesting story yesterday relying on data kept by the folks at the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, which suggests things are changing. It looks like the numbers for this year will be about 12%, possibly even 14% of the directors for the 100 highest grossing films are women. That is up significantly from where it usually is, which is around 4%.
What are some of the female-directed films that this year that did very well?
Well, there's Captain Marvel, which was co-directed by Anna Boden. Hustlers, which is directed by Lorraine Scafaria. There are also some movies coming up that look promising box office-wise. Charlie's Angels, which is directed by Elizabeth Banks. Little Women, directed by Greta Gerwig. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, directed by Marielle Heller. And Harriet by Cassie Lemons.
So what explains this increase then in women directors?
Well, one possible explanation is the story we started off talking about today, the Harvey Weinstein story, which led to the founding of Time's Up and a sort of general new willingness and awareness to talk about gender discrimination in Hollywood. There was also an EEOC investigation into the issue, which got some studios nervous that the federal government was looking at their hiring practices.
It's strange, though, right? Because the Harvey Weinstein story is such a terrible one. But if it leads to this, I mean, it's a tough thing to balance, it seems like.
It is. Certainly, that story has had repercussions in this industry and so many others that I think we're still beginning to understand and will be for years.
So it's one thing then, Rebecca, to have a good year. How is Hollywood working toward keeping those numbers up, not making 2019 a one-off?
There are some initiatives. For instance, Time's Up and the Annenberg folks launched this 4% challenge. They asked actors, studio execs, producers to commit to announcing one project with a female director in the next 18 months. Many prominent people have taken them up on that challenge. And then there are people like Ava DuVernay who have for years used their influence as producers to get other female directors work, you know, most notably on her show Queen Sugar. the reality is the key way people get work in Hollywood is by having already done work. It's by the performance of their past work. So if this group of women working in 2019 yields, you know, more for 2020, that would be great.
You can read Rebecca Keegan's work in The Hollywood Reporter. She's got a great piece out right now about DreamWorks Animation turning 25. Where has the time gone? And she speaks with us every Wednesday to give us the latest entertainment news. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, eh?
An author of books geared for young adults decides to aim older with her latest offering. Now, it's a leap considering her overwhelming success with her previous work, books that are getting the Netflix sword on the shoulder to become streaming series. Coming up, find out who she is and why she decided to take a break writing for the young folks. She's up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Leigh Bardugo is a best-selling author of various young adult fiction fantasy series, including Shadow and Bone, which takes place in a made-up world known as Grishaverse, with a young woman navigating among magical elites. Her books have sold more than 3 million copies, and her earliest titles are now being adapted for a Netflix series debuting next year. But this week, Bardugo released her first work of fiction for adults. It's called Ninth House, so we asked her to come in studio to tell us all about it.
Hi, I'm Leigh Bardugo. I'm the author of Ninth House. Ninth House is set among the secret societies of Yale. It is the story of Alex Stern, who is a young woman with a criminal past, and she's given an opportunity to attend this university as a member of the Ninth House that oversees the occult activities of the Ancient Eight, the oldest and most established societies at Yale. And that all is going, if not well, smoothly until a murder occurs on campus, and Alex is sure that the societies are involved. The idea certainly has its roots in my time at Yale. The societies have these beautiful, strange tombs or clubhouses all around campus. Skull and Bones, probably the most well-known of the societies, has this this bizarre kind of Neo-Egyptian temple built out of red stone. And Book and Snake has quite literally a mausoleum that is the size of an apartment building. So as an undergraduate, it was impossible not to be intrigued by these places. I think that there's a lot in Alex that is me. Not necessarily her experiences, though I am from Southern California, and though I did certainly feel like a fish out of water initially at Yale. But I think her anger at the culture she finds herself in contact with and in conflict with is very much my anger. I grew up in the Valley, which is its own country, really. It is its own place. And when I was about 11, we moved to Hancock Park. And it truly was like crash landing on an alien planet. I had been in a school where most of my class was Jewish. I was suddenly in a place where I was one of two Jews in my class, me and Alona Thal, the rabbi's daughter. So shout out to Alona. Also, this culture was so different. Everybody played volleyball and had these high blonde ponytails, and there was this disdain for books and reading and wanting to learn and loving school, which I initially did and soon didn't. I think Los Angeles is built to be alienating in some ways. The only way you survive here is by finding your neighborhood and your community. And then I went to Yale. I went to Yale in the dead of winter. I went to Yale in January, and it was cold and dark and so beautiful. And everywhere I looked, there was mystery and shadow and these glorious Gothic buildings and funny gargoyles and, of course, these tombs that I didn't know yet belonged to these societies. And there is a graveyard smack dab in the middle of the Yale campus. It could not have been a more perfect home for me. I think feeling like an outsider may just be in my DNA. I felt very alone, as I think many young people do in junior high and in high school. And what Yale gave me, the real gift it gave me, was finding the people that I truly identified with and felt close to and who became, in a way, my army. And I think this is a gift that Yale gives Alex, too. She is somebody who has struggled to find connection in her life and whose deep distrust of people has been borne out again and again. So the opportunity to actually open up to connection and make friends and then to be bolstered by them through this fairly dire adventure, I think, was important to me. For me, the process of writing a book is many days of feeling like a failure and then occasionally, magically, feeling like a genius for about 3 hours and then going back to my trough of failure. I didn't know how to write a book. I didn't know how to be a writer who experienced these feelings of complication and failure in relation to the work I was trying to do. And so I would start to write a book. And then I wouldn't know where I was going, and so I would set it aside. And it wasn't until I learned my process and learned how to outline that I actually began to understand the way I view story and the way I work through story, and that has never changed. It's the same way I approach every book. I wrote an absolutely garbage first draft of the book that would become Shadow and Bone. And it was messy, and it had lots of false starts and lots of placeholders, but I got through the beginning, the middle, and the end. And then I could step back from it and say, okay, this isn't a good book, but now I can make it good. It's easy to say, oh, your success out of the gate. But I think that that is part of our mythology about creative people. Shadow and Bone was a bestseller, but I was on the New York Times list for 1 week, and then I was gone. And it wasn't as if the hustle stopped there. It doesn't. I think we have this idea that if you can just hit a certain target, somehow that will mean you have arrived, and the work somehow will stop or ease, and that could not be further from the truth. A career is not about a book. It's not even about a series. It's about series after series after series.
And the Ninth House series, she says, will be as many as 12 books. That was author Lee Bardugo talking about her first novel for adults, Ninth House. Her Shadow and Bone and six of Crow's young adult books are being turned into a Netflix series that will debut late next year. And that conversation was conducted by Take-Two's Sue Carpenter and mixed by Sean Campbell. All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. If you missed any part of the show, just go wherever you get your podcast, and there we will be. Look for us, Take Two, waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me there as well, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.